avoid by paying for the thing in the first place. Chapter 12. Older Age. Someday, if you are lucky, the nightmare of paying for your kids' college will all be over. The kids will be out of school, and the loans will be paid off. More than one friend called life after finishing the college debt payments, "The biggest raise I ever got." But for many of us, as the kids are getting older, a big truth drives up. Our parents are getting older, too. Things start to get complicated, and that can mean money, too. And we are all aging. There's nothing new in discovering that you are part of the sandwich generation. With that comes the worry about our parents, if we're lucky enough to still have them in our lives, and the fretting over how the financial side of things will work out. What about the folks? Some 70% of people turning age 65 will probably need long-term care at some point, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And it's expensive. A 2010 HHS report estimates that costs in a nursing home can be more than $90,000, which is, you know, even more expensive than college. How in the world does that get paid for? Jean and I are the tail end of the baby boom. Our parents are from what has been called the silent generation, born between the 1920s and 1940s. The silent generation accumulated wealth. As they have aged, an industry has grown up, with federal assistance, to make sure much of that wealth got transferred to the elder care system. This is how Medicare works. You pay your assets down until you are broke, whether living independently or in an assisted living facility or a nursing home, and then Medicaid takes over. That is the way it is supposed to work, at least. We have known people who handled the transition poorly. Some tried to make sure that the aged parent will be eligible for Medicaid coverage and not let the assets go directly to health care providers, draining away any possible inheritance, by drawing down the parent's assets. But Medicaid has what is known as a 5-year look-back period. The feds check to see if someone applying for long-term care support has dumped assets to qualify for the coverage. If there's evidence of that kind of transfer, the government can impose a period of ineligibility. The result can be very expensive for the sandwich generation kids. It's complicated and scary. Money worries and old age, two great fears that go great together. Overhanging all of it is the worry that our folks won't get the care they need and deserve. We got our wake-up call about these issues when Jean's mom, Doris, needed a hip replaced. Having to figure out her care and what would happen if the recovery didn't go well sent us into fits of apprehension and research. We're lucky in some ways. Doris's sister was able to stay with her for the surgery and for a couple of weeks after. Jean and I were able to fly in to provide some help at that point, but we live 2,000 miles away and couldn't stay long. So we hired a home health aide to come in 3 days a week. We were told it wasn't covered by Medicare, but we knew it was important. And, in fact, the home health aide saved Doris's life, spotting a skin infection, cellulitis, 3 weeks after the surgery that was growing and could have been life-threatening. She got her to the hospital, and treatment began to clear the condition. Worth it? Absolutely. But still, expensive. Jean started signing up to work every festival and parade that the cops needed crossing guards for in order to help pay the home aid company. And as her mother's recovery dragged on, we asked ourselves whether her mother might need to be in an assisted living facility. My folks had looked into the same issues and initially decided on a very nice assisted living complex in Austin, where they live. They put down a substantial deposit, but they thought better of it after my younger brother reviewed the charges and told them they were exorbitant compared with what he could help them find nearer to him, in Florida. The decision was put on hold until 2017, when Dad had a few hospitalizations and it was time to make a decision. Working with my older brothers in Houston, my parents decided to move into a senior living complex in Houston, where they had ready access to medical care. With the money they hoped to make from selling their condominium in Austin, they expect to be able to afford the new place for years to come. Jean's father has also been thinking about these issues. He and his wife have been planning to move into a smaller home without stairs that would be easy to maintain. Jean's mom, however, had no such plan, except to occasionally tell Jean, "I'm going to die at home." And we didn't want to have to make a decision quickly if the surgical recovery didn't proceed well, or if other health problems came up. So we started doing some research. The federal government offers an online tool for comparing nursing homes at medicare.gov/nursinghomecompare/search.html and has a great deal of other information besides. There are also referral companies like A Place for Mom, a free service that helps people explore the options for caring for elderly parents. However, A Place for Mom gets its fees from the institutions it helps place people in. To writers like Paula Spann of the New York Times, this raises questions of potential conflict of interest. Spann has noted that local agencies on aging can provide the same information without the financial incentives. Jean and I began to study up on assisted living places. We looked up complexes in Houston, but had another thought as well. If need be, could we move her closer to us? Our house is 3 floors and not suited to an older person with mobility problems. But we thought maybe she'd be willing to live near us in an assisted living place in New Jersey. We took a tour. A facility wasn't far from our home. It was part of a chain, Care One, a New Jersey-based company that has about 70 centers across the Mid-Atlantic and New England states. After making an appointment, we walked into a place that looked like a Homewood Suites or Hampton Inn. Pleasant and generic, if not luxurious. The explosion of inexpensive architecture that put decent hotels at every interstate exit seemed to be helping to build this booming industry as well. This building had nice floors and a soaring entryway with a dining hall directly across a lobby from the front door. The building was just 11 years old and still looked new. A boombox sitting on top of a piano played oldies rock and roll, annoyingly loud for us, but probably okay for anyone hard of hearing. You could smell the food. It was 2 p.m., and lunch hadn't been over for long, and the smells weren't institutional. They made me hungry, which was a good sign. Charles, a friendly guy from Kansas, was the executive director of the place, and he sat us down to go over the basics. "There's a lot of confusion about terms," he said, "and people think of nursing homes when there's actually a range of living arrangements depending on how much help people need. It's not just putting people in nursing homes anymore," he explained, adding that nursing homes is an outmoded term. He was using a lot of terms whose precise definitions I didn't know, and I was getting confused. "We don't know what we're talking about," I said. He explained that assisted living is for people who need some help getting by from day to day, but don't have the kinds of health problems that require extensive medical care and a nursing home. I was familiar with the latter. My father's mother lived out her final years in a nursing home after an incapacitating stroke in her 50s. He told us that, with the aging of baby boomers, his industry was expected to triple in size in the next 15 to 20 years. People stay healthier longer now, and by the time they are ready to move into a place like Care One, they need a degree of help. To qualify for Medicaid, they must need help with at least 3 areas of life, like taking medications, getting around and getting food, and having motivation to take part in activities. He handed us a glossy folder with information about the facilities and a couple of pages of the charges, which were a little startling. Besides a community fee on moving in of $3,500, the basic room and board for what they called a studio apartment essentially a hotel room, was $5,680 a month. Share a room, and it could cost $3,853 a month. Then additional charges were tacked on, depending on what level of service you need. They were called activities for daily living, and could run from $30 to more than $100 a day. On top of that, medication assistance cost from $19 to $25 a day, depending on whether you take up to 15 medications a day or 16 or more. Yes, that's 16 or more. Beyond that were the ancillary services and charges, including about $12 for room service if you didn't want to go to the dining hall. A charge, he said with a smile, that's meant to encourage people to be social. A call system pendant would cost $175 a month, as would wander care. Chris said he understood that we were at the beginning of a confusing process and that we might not end up bringing Doris to New Jersey after all. Still, I'm happy to be a resource for you guys, he said. He walked us around and showed us the studio and the larger suites, which run $6,800 a month. Jean had told him that, with her mom's house and other assets, she estimated that she might have about $300,000 to deal with. Chris did the numbers in his head. A one-bedroom mid-size room would cost $6,300 a month, or about $76,000 a year. Doris's savings would pay, then, for about 4 years on her own dime. If she had continued income of $1,000 a month from Social Security or other sources, that would bring it down to about $64,000 a year, stretching out the assets to 5 years. The showrooms were nicely appointed. You bring in your own furniture, and on a dresser sat the book A Bittersweet Season by Jane Gross, which is about her care for her aging mother. Another terrific book on dealing with aging parents is When the Time Comes, Families with Aging Parents Share Their Struggles and Solutions, by Paula Spann. As our tour was ending, a piping alarm went off. A memory care patient was standing too close to the door of the locked wing she was in. She had to be persuaded to move. We walked by residents who seemed happy. A tall, older man who, in his youth, had played basketball for Rutgers. A woman with a walker. A cluster of people sharing a couch, looking like the grown kids visiting mom. That night, Jean called her mom and asked the most important question. What do you want? The two of them had arranged her powers of attorney and medical directive in case Doris had a medical crisis, but Jean wanted to know her wishes explicitly. And now, if she could no longer live alone, would she want to move in with her sister, Mary? Stay with her son, Steve, who lived near Dallas. Come up to New Jersey and live near us in an assisted living facility. First, Mary, she replied. Then you. Jean then called her brother and her aunt to tell them the score. Everyone seemed relieved to have answers. The next night, I was reading a little more about assisted living and came across this advice in the New York Times from an elder care counselor who said that many older people will never agree to have the conversation until a major medical catastrophe occurs. I turned to Jean, sitting across the living room with the book. This is what you just did. It took a medical problem to broach the subject effectively, but she had at least made a start. And then, what about our own retirement? We've done our planning for retirement as far as the money goes, but what will we actually do with ourselves when we are ready to quit working? Staying in the Northeast would not suit us. Once out of the daily working world, I'd sooner never pick up a snow shovel again. And please don't mention snow blowers. After a friend lost 3 fingers on his right hand to one, I lost my enthusiasm for them. While we can avoid snow duty by living in an apartment or condo, we would like to live in a place with a lower cost of living. 2/3 of retirees are likely to move at least once, according to a 2014 retirement study by Merrill Lynch and AgeWave, a company that studies aging issues. The survey found that only half of those retirees downsize. Some move into bigger places. By the age of 61, the majority of those surveyed said that they were free to choose where they wanted to live. How about traveling? Gene and I have talked about it off and on. We like the idea of travel, but in our way. Her dad bought a camper, customized from the big Mercedes-made Sprinter van. It's a popular option for people who want something more manageable than the behemoth Winnebagos and King Airs. He and his wife have driven Moby, their Sprinter, from Texas all over the continental United States and into Canada. All the RVs, however, were awfully expensive, and what suited her father didn't sound like something that would be a good fit for us. We're comfortable in smaller cars and can see ourselves traveling the country and staying in cheap hotels. It would take a lot of nights at Hampton Inns to make a fancy motorhome look more affordable by comparison. This is the sort of question that travel buffs debate endlessly. RV fans argue that buying smaller, used vehicles can change the cost comparison and can be cheaper than driving and staying in hotels. Other folks find even more unusual ways to live in retirement. In 2015, when I traveled across the Atlantic on the Queen Mary II as part of a New York Times Times Travels voyage, I met a couple who were always on the move. Robert and Beverly Johnson are in retirement, living without a home. We've now been traveling, basically with a rolling suitcase and a backpack apiece, for nearly 5 years, Bob told me in a note after the crossing. We typically spend about half a year in the States and half a year elsewhere, but this varies. Without housing expenses, he said, they have enough money to see the world. He referred to the two of them as geriatric hippies, who aren't rich, but who are lucky enough to have held on to the disappearing three-legged stool of pensions, Social Security, and invested savings. They make it work by traveling cheaply. On cruise ships, they take interior cabins. No Ritz-Carlton hotels, he wrote. They rent a room in Bob's sister's house, which serves as their legal address for credit card bills, taxes, and the like. It's a fascinating idea. It suggests that there are possibilities out there that most people have never thought about. Another weird but interesting notion, living aboard a cruise ship as an alternative to a retirement home. If you look into the idea, you might see stories about the late Beatrice Muller, a widow who lived for many years aboard the Queen Elizabeth II. She was spending about $100,000 a year to live full-time on the luxury liner. "Why should I go home to my vacuum cleaner?" she said to the writer Mimi Swartz in 2006. "If I run out of money, my sons will keep me here to keep me out of their hair. They're delighted I'm safe and happy." A 2004 paper in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society even suggested that the cost of cruise ship living could be comparable to the cost of assisted living. Assisted living companies, of course, dispute the math, and also make the point that while the meals and entertainment might be better aboard a cruise ship, geriatric medical care and other specialized treatment for older folks are not generally available on board ships, where such services are more general. Still, other retirees find ways to travel from place to place without constantly being on the move. Some senior living chains offer residents the option of moving from one facility to another, whether for brief visits or for a substantial part of the year. For more independent seniors, there is house swapping, sort of a mutual Airbnb. The movement that has been around for decades, with dozens of services like HomeExchange.com, HomeLink International, HomeLink-USA.org, and LoveHomeSwap.com, creating networks of people all over the world who vacation in one another's homes. It's not a vacation for last-minute dashers, but for those who can plan, the system seems to work. Some of the sites, including Intervac.com, offer long-term exchanges that can provide housing for months at a time. House-sitting sites include TrustedHouseSitters.com and MindMyHouse.com. There are networks that cater to over 50 travelers, whose schedules tend to be more flexible than families looking to head somewhere on school spring break, including Home Exchange 50 Plus, HomeExchange50plus.com, Senior Home Exchange at IVHE.com, and Home Base Holidays, HomeBase-Halls.com, which offers stays of up to 6 months. None of that sounds like Gene and me, though. We don't see ourselves roving the seas forever, or even the interstates, or crashing at a stranger's house. We really like the morning oatmeal at Hampton Inn. What can I say? Besides, at some point, we'd want to settle again. In the last year or so, the conversation has grown more serious. We've seen the articles, like the regular pieces in Forbes, touting the best places to retire. They focus on factors like the local economy, home prices, and air quality, as well as whether the town is walkable. The latest list has places like Blacksburg, Virginia. I've been there. It's terrific. And Fargo, North Dakota. Cons, cold winters. You don't say. The Milken Institute has produced its own data-driven report, ranking 352 metropolitan areas to find the best cities for successful aging. They really like Madison, Wisconsin. But who doesn't? All these reports are fine, as far as they go. More than anything, they help you figure out how other people figure out where they want to live in their retirement years, and the criteria that people sift through, and which you could sift through in your own way. How is the cost of living relative to the rest of the country? You can find cost of living calculators to do your own comparisons at sites like Bankrate.com, and extensive city comparisons on the basis of factors like income, crime, and climate at sites like city-data.com. Whatever the lists and reports might say about uprooting yourself and moving to a place you've never lived before, Gene and I feel the tug of our home state, Texas. We want to be near family. We want to spend time with that granddaughter and whoever else might come along. But where? Austin, the city we love most, has become crowded and expensive. If we lived in Pflugerville, the same town as the kids, though, there's always the possibility of being too much in their business. Jean had no interest in her own hometown, Houston, which she thinks of as unmanageably large. Then she surprised me by talking about my hometown, Galveston, with enthusiasm. "I've never lived in a beach town," she said. "It would be just a few hours' drive to get to Pflugerville and the kids, and an hour to see our Houston family members and to see theater productions there. Houston also has some of the best hospitals in the world, and that's no small consideration. More important, I love the salt air and the feel of sand between my toes. Please don't sing Jimmy Webb's song, Galveston. Growing up there, I've heard it enough for a lifetime. The Wall Street of the South before the devastating 1900 storm, the island town retains some of that old grandeur. Jean's dad, who lives in Houston, owns a trailer home in Galveston right off the beach that he and his wife love. When we came to visit, he pointed out toward the water. "This is the million-dollar view," he said proudly. He then pointed just a few hundred feet to the right, where actual million-dollar houses, the vacation houses of rich Houston folks, stood. We checked and found that we could buy a small condo or house there for around $100,000, the kind of place we might be able to buy with cash when we sold our home in New Jersey. Not one of the glorious old Victorian homes on the East End, or the expensive places down the island to the west, but something nice. And because the island is only 2 miles wide, you're never far from the beach. Galveston is not at the top of anyone's best places to retire list. It is not even listed in the Milken Report. Its beaches are not pristine, and the parts that are not spruced up are run down. The poverty rate, according to the U.S. Census, is about 25%. City-data.com says its crime rate is higher than the national average. The FBI, however, which collects those statistics, regularly warns people not to read too much into them, for a number of reasons. For example, some cities have a comparable amount of crime, but the police department in the supposedly higher crime city does a better job of recording offenses. But the Texas Gulf Coast is getting more attention as a place to retire as an alternative to more expensive beach towns in Florida. As a writer for the Huffington Post put it, when you combine affordability with natural beauty, it's surprising it's not up there with Florida as a top retirement destination. This was sounding better and better. The only problem with this idea, of course, is that it is absolutely nuts. Galveston gets smacked by hurricanes on a pretty regular basis. The house I grew up in, a solid brick structure that had survived a number of fierce storms, was destroyed by Hurricane Ike in 2008. What's more, climate change promises rising sea levels in the coming decades, and the potential for even more violent storms hitting Gulf Coast towns. As a reporter on the climate change beat, that possibility hit me hard. Gene's dad can lose that trailer. For him, it's a vacation home, not a primary residence. We would have to be prepared to lose everything if we bought there. We're not so attached to our possessions, though. The move from the big house in Millburn to the little place in West Orange meant getting rid of enormous amounts of stuff. Downsizing again to an even smaller place, whether a condo or a tiny house, would impose that discipline again and underscore the message. We would evacuate before any storm. No hurricane parties for us. FEMA has a good guide online about storm preparation and what to take when you evacuate. The list includes valuables, important papers on a thumb drive, and a go bag with food, medications, phone chargers, and other essentials. Buying an inexpensive place, or renting, at least until assisted living beckons, could lessen the financial sting if we lost in a storm. Flood insurance could mitigate losses. As long as we survive, the rest is just stuff. We could live with less risk in a place like Boise, Idaho. I like Boise. The state capitol building is a gem, and the river is lovely. You can get Basque food downtown. But I don't want to live in Boise. And it gets more than 20 inches of snow a year. The purpose of this exercise is not to convince you to live in Galveston. Though, you know, check it out. Our level of risk acceptance could well be very different from yours. I still eat Gulf oysters and shrimp, remember? And you might find sand between your toes annoying. But you can go to the same sites we did. Think about what's important to you in finding a place to live, and make your own decision. By the way, between my writing the first draft of this manuscript and the second, Hurricane Harvey hit the Texas coast with a wet fury that left Houston struggling with about 50 inches of rain. I flew to the Gulf Coast to report on the disaster. Galveston took a less dire hit, but things could have been much worse. While I was driving to dinner after flying with the cowboy who saved cattle by helicopter near Bay City, southwest of Houston, I got a call from Jean. "I'm going to betray you," she said. "I don't want to live in Galveston anymore." I told her I understood. A couple of days later, though, she was rethinking her rethinking. We're like that. We're still discussing our options. We're considering the very last steps, too. When we do pass away, we're leaving behind one very important thing. A book for the kids. Not Bogle or Trollope. Its title? What If? Workbook. It's basically a death organizer. A place to put bank accounts, retirement fund information, online accounts and passwords, life insurance information, credit cards, and such like. Jean ordered a copy after reading about it in a newspaper article. There are plenty of other books like it out there. She made filling it out a project, and it's ready when it's needed. We hope it saves the kids a lot of trouble. And as far as that final piece of real estate goes, we're not sure we want a burial plot. We don't want to be that much trouble. And no urn, please. We'll be all right in the ash heap of history. More important, we'll take a pass on those heavily marketed prepaid burial plans. They don't seem like a good deal, and can cost more than going over our preferences with the kids, who will take care of business at the right time, paid for out of a bank account they have access to, so it won't cost them anything. Your banker can even set up a separate account, payable after death. Prepaid plans, I have read, often go undiscovered, and only show up in the family papers after you've been buried. Haven't I wasted enough money during my life? I don't want wasting money to be the very last thing I do. Chapter 13. The End. Yet, sir, married men with families have lived on my income, and on less than a quarter of it. The very respectable man who brushes my clothes no doubt does so. But then you see he has been brought up in that way. I suppose that you, as a bachelor, put by every year at least half your income? I never put by a shilling, sir. Indeed, I owe a few £100. And yet you expect to keep a house over your head, and an expensive wife and family, with lady's maid, nurses, cook, footmen, and grooms, on a sum which has been hitherto insufficient for your own wants. I didn't think you were such an idiot, my boy. Thank you, sir. Anthony Trollope, Phineas Redux. I am still an idiot. Okay, that's not fair. I've absorbed a lot, which must have raised my money IQ by a few points, and maybe I've even improved my money sanity. There's no better way to learn about something than writing a book, at least so long as you take the work part seriously. I'm still basically scared of money. I've just gotten used to paying more attention to it. Zero out credit card balances. Invest in index funds. And I've learned it's never too late to start building a retirement fund, though earlier is better. And let's face it, I didn't actually make myself a financial expert. I picked up some information, but it's not as if I went back to college for an MBA. The lucky thing is that you don't have to be an MBA to fix your financial life. Even those supposed financial geniuses, as we found out, don't consistently beat the market. A few simple rules did the trick, and when it came to everything else, insurance, a will, and the rest, I found good people and listened to them. That doesn't make me an accredited financial maven, but it did get the job done. When Kinky Friedman, the singer and comic novelist, was running for governor of Texas, he argued that his lack of experience was not a problem. I tell people, trust me, I'm a Jew. I'll hire good people. And I am, like Kinky, a Jew. I am, in fact, a Jew who is not particularly good with money, even now. So much for that stereotype. But after some false starts, I have learned enough to make some good decisions, and how to hire good people. If I've done my job right, then you've learned those things too. That would be so great. If you meet me somewhere, say, at a book talk, please come up to tell me that you learned something. Lie if you have to. I'm insecure. And while I'm confessing here, let me admit that this project took a little more than a year, despite the title of the book. Sue me. But you don't need to take more than a year to do what we did. Here's one last punch list. A task a month for a year. The list won't fit on an index card, but it's pretty concise. And now that you've seen us do these things, you have a better sense of the terrain. Give it a year. Make this the year that you get your financial life in order. Whether or not you think you can make it, take the steps. As Hamlet told his mother, assume a virtue if you have it not. Or as people in Alcoholics Anonymous say to those trying to put themselves on the path to sobriety and wonder whether they are up to the challenge, fake it till you make it. January. Are you on track for retirement? If you have a 401k fund, check it to see if you're on track. Check the composition. Are you in low-fee funds, preferably index funds? If you have a pension, what will it pay you? Check your expected Social Security payment for whatever year you think you might retire. Will the combination give you a substantial portion of your current income? Remember, the rule of thumb is about 75%, but you should think of what you'll really need. February. What do you need to do to catch up? If you're not going to get to the 75%, or whatever you're hoping for, you need to find a way to get there. That means paying the maximum into a 401k, and if you are 50 or older, taking advantage of the senior bump up to put in more. If you haven't got a fund yet at all, and you're in your 50s, you've got a tough climb ahead. Skip vacations if you have to. Yes, even skip those lattes. This is emergency mode, and you can still build up a cushion with effort and discipline. Remember, Kerry Schwab Pomerantz says that if you are starting in your 50s, you need to put away 40% of your income, and maybe more. It might call for a lifestyle change, and this is the month to see if you can put these processes in place. March. Read a book that will make you think about money. It could be any of the books from my financial bookshelf. But why not David Copperfield, so you can meet Mr. Micawber? Or, if you're feeling ambitious, start Anthony Trollope's Barsetshire novels or Palliser series. Those books say more about getting and spending than any financial guide. April. Write a will and take care of the medical directive and power of attorney documents. We got a lawyer to do it. You probably will too. May. Check your life insurance. Have you got any? Have you got enough? Do you understand what it will do or won't do for your family? June. Clean up your credit cards and other debts. Renegotiate interest rates. Examine your phone bills for mysterious charges. And see whether a call to the phone company's helpline won't get you a lower monthly rate. Do it again with your cable company. And then look at other subscriptions. Are you really listening to Spotify? If not, why are you paying for it? Subscriptions creep up all around us. Netflix, Hulu, Apple Music. Make sure you're getting the most out of what you pay for, or don't pay for it. July. If any of the previous tasks took more than a month, you've got this one to take up the slack. August. It's August. You don't want to work in August. September. Begin the conversation with your kids about how much support they can expect from you, their needs and yours. And, looking further forward, be sure to talk with them about your own choices for end-of-life decisions with copies of your own financial assets workbook, will, and medical directive documents. November. If your parents are still around, make sure you know what they want and study up on their care options as their health declines. You don't want to be taken by surprise. December. It's been nearly a year. Check back over the list and see if you've handled these things to your satisfaction. Double-check that retirement fund and look at whether you're making the progress you need to be. It's not a one-time set of decisions. It's a process. And then, congratulate yourself on a year well spent. Here we are at the end of our story, though I hope nowhere near the end of our lives. Indulge me for a moment. I want to talk about another book, one that begins in the beginning. For many years now, I have attended a Bible study class. Since we're Jewish, our focus is on what Christians call the Old Testament, which Jews call the Torah, or the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. I'm not actually religious, but the Torah is just about the most fascinating book I know, and understanding its stories underlies so much of our literature and of Western culture that it's an essential work to know. Besides, the funny, friendly members of Congregation Emmanuel of West Essex have made the classes the best book club ever. It's a strange project, this book club, because when we started, some 15 years ago, it was decided to go through every word of the Torah, from Genesis to Deuteronomy, from start to finish. In a world that skims, we linger. In a society that has lost its attention span and even too long didn't read is abbreviated on Twitter as TLDR, we take the Torah pokily, deliberately. Even so, we recently completed Deuteronomy. Then we started the book all over again. Why? Because there's always something new in it, and not everyone was there for the first in the beginning. I came in a year or so after the class started, when they were already in mid-Genesis, so it was nice to go restart the cycle. But I digress, yet again. Here's the point. Among the repeated themes in Deuteronomy, this last of the five books is one of the most searing messages delivered to the gathered Hebrews. They are about to enter the Promised Land after wandering 40 years in the desert. God tells them, through Moses, that he has set before them a blessing and a curse. Make the right choice, do good, follow the commandments and laws, and you will live, and even prosper. Choose wrongly, and, well, things get very bad. The curses are enumerated at length, at great length. Death. Being scattered across the earth with nothing. Hemorrhoids. Really, it's in the book. I'm telling you, you've got to read this thing. The movies don't do it justice. We can argue about deeper meanings, but the fact is that we all have the blessing and the curse before us, however you want to think of it, and whatever the nature of the reward or the punishment. Most of us choose wrongly. Punishment for those failings are a major theme of the book. From the flood, to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, to the slaughter after the golden calf. It's why there is so very much smiting. I really enjoy the smiting. It's why, despite all the wrongness and the smiting, we still get the message to go out there and choose to do the right things. Is it hard to do these things? Yes. Are they impossible? No. I'll let Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 11 through 14, say it better than I ever could. Surely this instruction which I enjoin upon you this day is not too baffling for you, nor is it beyond reach. It is not in the heavens that you should say, "Who among us can go up to the heavens and get it for us and impart it to us, that we may observe it?" Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, "Who among us can cross to the other side of the sea and get it for us and impart it to us, that we may observe it?" No. The thing is very close to you, in your mouth and in your heart, to observe it. We can choose to do good. And now I'm back talking about our little book here, not the book. Because while yes, we should make the right moral choices on the grand level of life or death, we must also at least try to make the right financial ones. One good act leads to another, and another. Thus our habits built. And if we do make those right choices, and have a little luck, we will enjoy good fortune. No guarantees, but you could do worse. This is Kaleo Griffith. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of This is the Year I Put My Financial Life in Order by John Schwartz. This program was directed by Harry Nangle. Executive Producer, Nick Martorelli. Text Copyright 2018 by John Schwartz. Production Copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.